read it till the harvest. Enough is a feast. Where is the balance, the equilibrium position, where the forces of nature all meet in harmony? So there is enough of everything, for everyone, just enough. For every Range Rover, there's a mother with starving children, probably several. For every holiday on the piste, there's a child walking 5 miles for water, dirty water. For every villa in the Med, there's a farmer whose crops have failed, facing ruin. Where is the balance? Where is the equilibrium? Where enough is a feast. Let us rid the world of consumerism and growth, and call them by their name, greed. Let us banish them and search for the balance, the equilibrium, where enough is a feast, that everyone may eat.
Next we have one of our regulars, Sheila Tyson.
Thank you, Sue. I thought I was vote number 7. Pilgrim's sword. I wake slowly, eavesdropping on the faint creak of the outer helm, the wind and the rigging now more plaintive, feeling the pitch more adamant, quiet gush from the air heater fan, the heave on the same tack more manifest, sensing the steeper roll. In my mind's eye, I see that huge wheel, unmanned, twitching, the masthead light slashing a zigzag arc through the Milky Way, like a white star on a yo-yo. I picture the skipper as he cajoles the indifferent face of the chart plotter to reveal a stream of cartographic data from a galaxy of satellites to explode in a myriad of coloured pixels. Then it dawns on me, no engine, no more motor saving. It was the silence that woke me. I rolled further downhill in cosy luxury, my ear an inch from the soporific gurgle as the ocean sluices past our hull, the moon's hidden pull on the tide adding 3 knots to our speed. 2 more hours of bliss left on watch below before the time to rise again. It is 1:50 a.m. Easter Sunday. Thank you.
And now we have our bank holiday disruptive element, Jerry Murphy. You're welcome to hold that for us.
It's going to follow up to the equilibrium formula. It's called Doppler effect. For all the world like the sound of a Formula One car, with its high-pitched wail sharpening as it approaches and shortening to an incredible blast of sound as it passes, except slower, much slower. The roller beggar on the corner spots me from 40 feet away and begins her pleading whine, which deepens to a practiced moan as I pass briskly by and lengthens out again to a disappointed plaint, upon which I am spotted by the next roller bearer, to 40 feet away on the bridge. Now, on the passing of a self-important poet, your death, when it comes, will not create a vacuum, more a pigeonhole.
Okay.
Actually,
You want to come back to the mic? It's all recorded, you know. Next we have Patricia Walsh.
Thank you, Susan. And this is called the last spaghetti junction. Spaghetti junctioned on a chair that blithely soothes your weight. You form blossoms of smoke when you with your overdrawn cigarette. Is it just me or did I not see the joke? All the streets have now disappeared, tolerance being your indolence, without re debauchery. But you are just another fashion statement, a license to be born somewhat, like a walking abortion, scattered along your own spaghetti junction, twisted and turned into the beautiful shape that well becomes you.
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia. And next we have Joanne Collins.
Can I read one short and one long? Leaving, moving on, trying to feel firm and be strong so as not to fall and lose it all. Keep strong, relax, don't feel alone or have a freak attack. Everything will work out soon, everything will sit right back. Cain fall gwil se co yacker dinna all in green for agus canasta oil. Coil me rodig and bliant o hin, ach nilam ro cinta post gadaim. Coil me lan chantana, ach si me ro og, gwalum chant ala oil. So sulugam gwil chant ala post ar foil. Vul me vukali agus ferolin, ach si me ro kulanta, agus marxin coil me madeshna, ach ni coilig me arise. Mar to se roite gom anish, agus tá súlagam go dénig mé. Grá cabhfuil an grá gan deos tá sé an só agus san nachhaid idir mé féin agus na clan, na bhaile, na mo chairde ar na sreidna ach an grá idir burtíine is é an rud a ceapan a bheith dheacair. An bhfuil ceart agam nó an bhfuil sé éasca.
Thank you, Joe. And next we have Ralph O'Part.
Protestant Pope. My anger and frustration lead to my self-devaluation, to degradation, lethargy and sloth. By sitting, smoking, thinking, procrastinating and drinking, I get to a place where I don't give a toss. And the only thing I found to consistently make my world go round is work, practice, effort. Call it what you will, hate, and sometimes it's a bitter pill, but still, work, practice, effort leads to true relaxation instead of sitting around biting off my fingernails in frustration. Work, practice, effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. And next we have Al McKinney.
Outside for a smoke, I met Johnny, a man of 43 years, a nagging spilled over an orange, his blue eyes bulging with tears. I am calmer now after meeting him, destroyed by the depravity of drink. Something arising and something colliding with the force of gravity's brick wall. Johnny was concaving with Calamity's demise about the subjects that follow them cry, and follow life and love derided, Derrida and Dostoevsky, deluded and denied. All rise, judgment without, void who the hopeless and who the pride, who the lied and who the tried, failed only to remember, after was laid and this was only a ride. Only a disorientating ride meant to grant experience, meant to lead you just a shore wide of the easy grooves and moldless belongings of simple possession, of nothing much but to reside in who you are and what you cannot decide, a pristine paradigm of birth and death, of longing to be satisfied, a screwing of subdivisions into one immeasurable lot, a clot of potencies dying to rot and stink and grow again in garlands and Gethsemanes of grateful burden beauty, may slack with time and effort. Get down upon your knees and gesticulate a great genuflection of gumption and grand design. My pardon. Next we have Kieran McCarthy.
This is called Working Toward the Extremity. The future is an ambition of the past, and the past is a longing of the future. Like a dead tree, a limp sway where its leaves used to be, everything is wilting towards extremity. In between lies nothing but coughing passion and wistful desire, more and more, hunger, rage, fret and sweat, folly, hope. A dream of the young, of what is to come, the morning old for what might have been. Happiness is first, happiness is last, happiness was a dream in a wasted past. Potential dances in the idle gaps of young minds, regret lingers in the empty hallways of age. The calm and the still have begun to move. Possession of something desires something else. The feet march to the poles of discontent. Assemble, assemble, rebel, rebel. Budding ideas stamped on by restlessness. March to the drum of the satisfied unsatisfied. Potential is food for regret, youth for memory. Everything, everything is working towards extremity. Thank you.
Thank you, Kieran. And next we have Michael Cahan.
I was prepared for next week, and it turns out this week is different. So I had to come up with something because I had put my name down. So I remember a song I wrote in about 1991 when there was this horrific Balkans war broke out after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the whole collapse of the communist Eastern Europe, and then this horrific war on Europe's and fringes, and it was just like watching horror in slow motion, and it was not very pleasant because the British sent in, under the UN manifest, to protect what was going on in Srebrenica, Sarajevo, and it just didn't happen. So anyway, this was me in 1990, not writing so much a poem but a song that went, the neighbor states are fighting, it's an ugly, vicious war, with violence and hatred, oh, it makes no sense at all. So we send in our armies and their white tanks, blue uniforms, but we don't want them fighting, for this is not our war. And somewhere a little girl has gone to carry water. She cannot see the sniper where he hides behind the wall. So she dies in the street while we're watching from a distance, saying, this is not our war. No, this is not our war. For we are the boys of the disunited nations. We like to talk of liberty and universal law. But you'll starve in your enclave while we're watching from our TV screens, saying, this is not our war. No, this is not our war. They say they'll be happy to discuss our propositions for ceasefires and peace talks, an end to this war. While we're debating, they're advancing their positions, they're breaking every deadline, and they're laughing at us all. And somewhere a little girl has gone to carry water. She cannot see the sniper where he hides behind the wall. She dies in the street while we're watching on our TV screens, saying, this is not our war, and this is not our war. For we are the boys of the disunited nations. We like to talk of liberty and universal law. But you will die in the street while we're watching from a distance, saying this is not our war. That's it.
We're coming to the end of our evening, and we have some dessert. And the dessert tonight is Colin McManus, the short story.
Thanks, Sue. Just two things. I started this story a third of the way in, and also it's a piece that's written sort of from two points of view, so it might change a little bit halfway through. And what you think is repetition, it's not, it's just two point of views in the same time. Capsule. Pressure. The squad had just passed the barrack door going towards Hill Road and Tom Hegarty's when Sergeant John Doyle and Gerard Unson Ryan exited and strolled down the low street in their newly issued short sleeved shirts. According to Gerard Ryan's watch, it was exactly 2:17 p.m. They both got the strong smell of pitch. They passed the alleyway. They could see men milling with steaming black buckets and steam coming out the back of a truck. Hot asphalt was being poured on the flat roof of the grocery shop, the source of the smell. With the afternoon sun moving to the west, Low Street was in shade from the three-story Georgian block that housed the grocers, the drapers, and the bank. The premises would close their doors at 3. Threats had been issued to proprietors that hadn't shut their doors for the previous marches. The bank porter with a bandage on his hand was sweeping out the porch of the bank. The two guards spoke briefly with him. Guard Ryan took up his usual spot in a low doorway to the side alley of the bank. He always stood in that doorway at night. Having to stand slightly hunched in the low doorway made him look taller than he actually was. From this position, Ryan had full view of High Street from the red bank on the corner to the two cut stone private dwellings at the far end. In between was Hawks Butcher's with its big windows and mosaic tile front, then the chemist and Manny's paper shop, and then the row of public houses that he could observe emptying out. There was the tailor's jammed with old suits and its pub in at the back. The Yanks, nothing to note except his mouth. A small house with a family of eight in it. The Thatch, a public house with a thatched roof, a side entrance, Shell House, a public house with its facade decorated in shells, Doonan's, a small grocery with a pub at the back, and finally Paddy Donegan's, a restaurant, come sweet shop, come pub, and private lounge for ice creams on a Sunday. Black flags hung limply from every pole. There wasn't a breeze. He watched the sergeant stroll ahead on down Low Street. No doubt he'd have only one of two things on his mind, shooting or boxing. He watched a gossan with no shirt kick a punctured ball up against the wall of the thatched public house. He checked his watch, 2:22. Joe Healy, the tin grocer in his white shop coat, left his shop with the day's takings in a leather bag, walked on the footpath past the drapers and the bank, and greeted Gerard Ryan with a comment about the weather before crossing the street. He was early today. He climbed the steps with the metal railing beside the copper beech tree onto High Street. He smiled at the gossam. He passed a drinks company sales rep with a black folder under his arm as he entered the tailor's. The shopkeeper mounted the footpath and passed between Hawk's shop and his light blue Ford Cortina Mark III. That Cortina would be an easy target for any Dublin courier. The lanky grocer deposited the leather bag in the night safe of the Red Bank. As he did so, Ryan could hear the slow closing thump of the heavy brass drawer of the safe, which was built into the brickwork of the bank's facade. As the sergeant crossed to Jimmy's, the shopkeeper stopped him up to have a word. They spoke for a moment in the middle of the street before making his way back up Low Street by Guard Ryan and back in the shop. The sergeant had finally made it to Jimmy's and stood in the doorway. Ryan checked his watch. 2:29. A maroon Hillman Hunter registration number AIT8105 was parked under the high street wall, partially in shade. A miner sat with his elbow out the window. His wife was in the shop. Ryan could hear Devil Woman coming from the car. Ryan knew the miners finished work early, but Saturday was usually their shopping day. On Saturday, there'd be a line of cars under the high street wall with the men sitting in them waiting for their wives or mothers to get the shopping. Sweet as pie. And them and their sons and brothers would wreck the place on Saturday night. Ryan fingered the truncheon in his pocket and could still get the smell of pitch. He decided he didn't like it. The Horselips had packed the Mayflower the previous Saturday night, and Ryan made two arrests for urinating in public. One of the culprits was pissing in the keyhole of the door to the men's drapers. The doors were teak frames with full-length glass panels, a brass handle and a keyhole with a brass escutcheon at Mickey height. The culprit was pissing into the keyhole and watching through the glass as it spread onto the premises when a never-officious Guard Ryan caught him. A black beer lorry changed down and nearly stopped as it struggled at the top of Mill Hill in front of Jimmy's and came across the white line when turning onto Low Street, wedging an orange Volkswagen Beetle onto the curb and then passed up in front of Ryan. Two brothers, the head of other, passed down High Street. Ryan didn't know them. He'd asked the sergeant when he got the chance. A balding farmer with a hitching knife across the handlebars passed up on the Honda 50. He had a handkerchief on his head to protect him from the sun. He waved at the boy and ignored Ryan. Ryan didn't know him either. He'd make a note of it. He'd get him when the new helmet-wearing laws came in. Mrs. Shellhouse poked her nose out from her doorway and looked at her watch, wondering if she should close the doors. She gave a short wave and a smile over to Ryan, and he nodded back. "Never mind waving, ma'am, and just empty your premises on time and we'll get along just fine." He checked his watch, 2:33. He checked that the sergeant was in position. The sleek-haired sales rep went into the Yanks. The beer lorry had done a U-turn onto the high street and was inching its way down between the wall and the premises. The truck released a hiss of air as the handbrake was applied. Two stout men, both in their undervests, shoulders red and peeling from too much sun, climbed down and were talking as they donned red rubber gloves. The aluminium rails of the truck rattled as they were undone. They talked as full barrels of porter dropped onto a dirty, tatty cushion and clinked as they were manhandled and rolled onto the concrete street. Ryan couldn't hear what they were saying. Wild boys from Sligo. Annie Welsh, a slight woman in a floral skirt and summer blouse with the sleeves rolled up, carrying a bunch of flowers by her side, walked quickly down High Street. She had to squeeze her way between the beer lorry and the wall. And look at herself. Where's she heading for? There are no bells to be rung now. He looked at Jimmy's, but the sergeant was gone from the doorway. The boy's mother came out the front door and down the set of steps by the lime tree, crossed the street and went into the grocer's. The slinky sales rep waved it at the Yanks and entered the pub with the thatch, where the boy was kicking the ball. The beer lorry moved forward to make another drop and the brakes hissed again. The boy followed the rep into the door of the public premises. Ryan could hear the door rattle as it shut. The tarry smell of hot pitch clung in his nostrils. He pinched them, momentarily, inconspicuously. He checked his watch, 2:37. 23 minutes to go before these bousies march, and in this one-horse town it'll all be over in 5 minutes. Two cars jammed with men, mud flaps scraping the road, flew back black flags out the windows and tooted as they passed Ryan. He played with the truncheon strap. That's how they spot car bombs in Belfast, the rear end down. Cute fuckers, though, started beefing up the shots. He looked for the sergeant. He was in the doorway again. The squad passed him, rolling slowly. Dunn stuck his tongue out of him. He watched as they rolled towards Jimmy's. He'd give his left ball to be in that car with those boys. As the sergeant crossed the square, he noticed that John Joseph's black bike with the raincoat tied in the carrier with bailing twine was leaning up against the wall of the post office. When the sergeant reached Jimmy's, John Mulvey was a then eight and a cone, as he'd say himself. John Mulvey wore a wide-brimmed straw hat and a light ex-going-to-mash shirt with the sleeves rolled neatly up and the neck open. Bits of hay and seed were trapped in the light golden hairs in his chest and arms. His face, neck, forearms and the V in his chest were burnt red from the sun. He was binned in Jimmy's ear about a pin that broke on the finger of Armore. He couldn't get one anywhere. He had a meadow half knocked. He'd have to go to Ballyfarna for the part. That'd take him most of the day. He'd be in bother if it rains. It's promised good for a fortnight, according to the BBC, Jimmy said. Jimmy was in his usual position, leaning on his elbows out over the ice cream fridge and looking out the door while Mulvey spoke. Three different coloured biros poked sharply from his breast pocket of his blue chaperote. He had watched the sergeant and Ryan leave the barracks and walk down the street and watched the sergeant as he crossed the square towards his shop. The shop darkened as the sergeant filled the doorway. Mulvey was enjoying standing deep in the cool of Jimmy's, but left when the sergeant arrived. That's a day for the beach, Jimmy said. Well, it'd be better than this nonsense anyway. Give me one of those cones before this thing starts. Not too big, two twists, the sergeant says. How will we fare Sunday? Any Joe Bugners? Jimmy asked. The sergeant, as he manoeuvred himself off his elbows and plucking a cone, pulled the cream-coloured lever on the stainless steel cone machine. The cooler kicked in and the machine shuddered and hummed. The sergeant watched the arse of a beer lorry send a burst of diesel fumes in his direction as it took off up Low Street. Now we have a few contenders. Do you think so? There's a good crop coming through. Stick one of those flakes in it as well. The cone machine shuddered to a stop. The chrome-grilled beer lorry was now coming down High Street. The sergeant hoped the bowsies on the truck had the wit to stand down when the march was going past. Ryan was still looking at that fucking watch of his. Sergeant Doyle stood looking out the door and maintaining full view up Low Street and High Street, but was back far enough so Ryan couldn't see him eating the cone. He heard a tractor coming down the hill from the church. He'd look when he finished the cone. Out on the footpath he'd be able to see up Convent Avenue and down Mill Hill. Will they do damage to the Kilty boys? They should, they should. There was a bit of boxing down below Saturday night, I heard. There was a scuffle. Nothing new there. Young bucks from Arigna. Those rock bands bring in that sort of clientele. The Rose Hips, they call themselves. Did you ever hear the likes of it? The fucking Rose Hips, Jimmy said. They're all the same, the sergeant replied. He watched Annie Welsh round the corner at the Red Bank. The footpath narrowed to a mere ledge there. In fact, it wasn't practical at all. Its narrowest part, just enough for a footing, lined with a protruding sandstone windowsill at shoulder height. The sergeant knew he'd have to leave the footpath and step onto the road to get around the 90-degree angle. He admired Annie's neck as she leaned out to avoid the sill and went round without breaking her stride with flowers for the altar. You were on your own too, I heard, Jimmy probed. He took one step forward and stood in the door and talked back over his shoulder to Jimmy. Aye, the other buck was up apprehending the keyhole pisser. Douglas must be delighted. That's been going on for weeks. On the street, John Mulvey was tilting back and forth on the edge of the footpath, with one hand behind his back, finishing his cone. The squad pulled into the curb and the sergeant took a step out from Jimmy's door, placed his elbows on the roof to lean in the passenger window. The roof was hot, so he bent over and put his hands on his knees instead, bringing his big face level with Dunn's. He could still get the chocolatey taste of the flake in his mouth, and wondered if Dunn would be able to smell it. Dunn never moved from his reclined position and spoke. They're lining up out of the school. They're ready to kick off any minute now. There's a good crowd of them. The branch boys reckon there's a few chaws from the north down as well. Just then, the tractor rounded the corner at the Red Bank and into the square. The driver was stripped to the waist and bouncing on the seat. He held the bottom of the steering wheel with one hand and the other hand hung from the thumb off the chrome accelerator lever that was touching his knee. A steady plume of black smoke spurted high in the air from the rusted exhaust. It was Clint Tansey. He had left his elderly mother and father sweating at the hay. He got away by tempting them with the prospect of lemonade, their only indulgence, and timed his trip to coincide with the march. Clint always stopped at Jimmy's. He could park at the top of the hill because the 35 was hard started, and turned the front wheel into the curb because the handbrake was gone. He jumped down and, while pulling his beltless jeans out of his crotch, greeted Sergeant Doyle. How's it going, Chief? The sergeant had asked him out the evening before in a dog hunt, and now Clint thought they were comrades. The sergeant stalled the squad for as long as he could. He had no interest in sharing gun stories with Clint, but Clint wasn't leaving. He went into Jimmy's. The squad turned in the square, headed back up Low Street and parked at the barracks to await the march. The sergeant stood back into Jimmy's, just far enough to be out of the sun. Clint was eating the chop ice and telling Jimmy about shooting Tom Higgerty's pointer. "The move is on," the sergeant alerted Jimmy. The boy with the ball had gone off the street. His mother came up the steps with a bag of carrots and went into the house. The men on the beer lorry stepped into Shell House and were stood 2 pints. The miner switched off the music. He didn't know what was keeping his wife. The shopkeeper and the bank porter pushed out the bank door. Douglas turned the key in the teak doors and pulled down the blue blinds. Publicans began to stick their heads out, retreat, and close out their doors. Curtains were pulled. Thank you.